Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. A delight to have you all with us. Panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to get in on the conversation, what we do here is we welcome your letters. And if you have something to say about what we're talking about and a thought, a question, something you would like to hear the panelists opine on, well, all you have to do is send us a note. We get a ton of letters. We can get to a few of them. And all that we ask is you keep them short and to the point and on topic and proofread them. And we'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Please only use that address. But the key really is to keep them as short as possible so we can get to as many as possible during the course of the morning. With all of that said, let me introduce everybody to you and we'll get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here fresh from a taping of the Media Project. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good, and there's no better thing in the world than brewed coffee.
I'm drinking some as we speak, Alan. I agree with you.
It sustains us.
Yes, it does. So you have a hot cup of Joe in front of you?
I do, and it's in a great-looking mug which says Entering Great Barrington with a handle on it. Excellent.
Fantastic. Terrific. Speaking of the Berkshires, Berkshire Eagle reporter extraordinaire Jen Smith is with us this morning. Good morning, Jen. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. And I raise my cup of English breakfast tea to you all.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Thank you. And to you. Yes, we're all doing it in the studio here. We're all raising our cups to you. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler joins us once again. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. And I got my Diet Coke here.
All right.
Hey, Joe, remember when we used to drink?
How many caffeines have we got?
Yes, those are a lot of caffeine.
Hey, Joe, remember when we used to drink a Diet Coke?
I know.
But we're off of that now.
I know. I'm entering my, I think, eighth month. Wow. Ninth month.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So not that I'm counting or anything, but I don't really miss it.
Of what?
Of not drinking Diet Pepsi. I was addicted to Diet Pepsi.
As was I.
Yeah. So when I fell down the stairs and took out my knees, and I was on pretty good painkillers, I just stopped it altogether, and that helped. That other voice you heard was one Linda Ellerbe. She is a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist, and we are thrilled to have her with us each week. Good morning, Linda. How are you?
Iced espresso. My only caffeine dinner today.
That's good. That's very good.
Joe, can I say something for 1 second?
Of course.
Okay. I just want to tell you how excited I am to be on with Linda. She won't remember, but a while back, my first national TV was a Nick News interview with her. So I've been a fanboy for a long time. So Linda, I've been awed.
Tell me what was the subject? This is what age sounds like, folks, and looks like.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
It was on Robots for Kids, and I'll send you a backstory email.
Yes, please do. Almost anybody there knows my email.
Oh yeah, Jim has it because we sent out the stories, so that's fine. But I'll tell you, that's very cool. That's very cool. I'm sure you were one of her favorite guests, Jim.
I thank you for saying yes to us on Nick News and for helping us explain the world and what you know to kids.
We
lived by the kindness of people and the understanding and the intelligence of people who understood that children were not dumb. They were younger and shorter, but not dumb, and that they deserved respect from people like you who know things in telling them things.
Well, and go ahead.
Not always shorter.
Yeah.
I was one of the tall kids watching Nick News growing up.
I'm still one of the shorter ones.
Well, speaking of dumb, let's talk about what's going on in the news. and we'll start there. And although the first story here, I do want to talk about the first appearance last night of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and it took place in Wilmington, Delaware. The pair hammered President Trump in his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And I will say that it seems, and most press reports agree, that Senator Harris has earned praise from Wall Street and Silicon Valley and environmental activists, and the pick is widely being praised. I think it's safe to say that, of course, there are some negatives, but for the most part, it's been a good ride for her and for the pick. It was the first official appearance as Mr. Biden's vice presidential choice. Ms. Harris, a former prosecutor, repeatedly assailed Mr. Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic and the economic upheaval it has caused. As somebody who has presented my fair share of arguments in court, the case against Donald Trump and Mike Pence is open and shut, Harris said. The appearance held at the Alexis DuPont High School in Wilmington, Delaware, offered the first indication of how Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris, two Democrats from opposite coasts and different generations, would fuse their messages as they sought to unseat Mr. Trump this fall. The two cast themselves as the right pair to guide the nation that has been upended in recent months, both by the virus and by nationwide protests over racial inequality and police brutality. All right. Alan, anything you'd like to add to this?
Yes, I was a very happy person watching what I saw. I thought both Biden and Harris distinguished themselves. And it was only made more poignant by the fact that Trump then came on to try to beat them up. And in his usual mumbly, grumbly, I can't put a sentence together way, just showed the distinction that the Democrats were going to have an advantage based on what we were seeing. So I was a happy camper.
Yeah, it was. It seemed if you were. I realize it's hard to do this, but to put partisanship aside, to just look at an event, it's all did seem to go well yesterday. Linda, I'm interested in your input, not only on the event yesterday, but just in the overall choice. We did talk about it yesterday, but I'm curious as to your thoughts.
Yesterday, needless to say, I have quite a lot to say on the subject of the fact that we have a woman running for high office again, and how the nation is going to react and how these various things. First of all, I thought, just to address the news conference yesterday, I thought that how she handled herself in that news conference absolutely showed why he chose her.
Linda, we're having trouble.
Me too, yeah.
You're chopping in and out. I don't know why.
No, and
I'm on
what
my
happened,
landline. Do you want me to call, hang up and call back?
Now you see, then you were perfect.
Yeah.
So whatever you're doing now, keep doing it.
Finish up, and maybe during the break we'll have you go on a different line. But yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Okay, no, that's I have much to say on this whole issue, but one thing I want to say from the start, because I've already heard this happen on NPR, not on this show, I haven't heard it happen yet, and in the media. And I have to go back to a personal story for this. Some years ago, I needed to have knee surgery, and my doctor and the surgeon agreed that nothing but surgery, knee replacement surgery, was going to do it. But my insurance company wouldn't pay for it until I went through a year of cortisone treatments first. So I went to the doctor who was going to give me cortisone. It was recommended by another doctor, and I'm in the examining room. And he comes in, and he's wearing a name tag, and I see that his name is Brian McLean. I've made that up for the moment. And he walks in, and he sticks his hand out to me, and he says, "Hello, Linda, I'm Dr. McLean." And I looked at him, and I said, "No, if I'm Linda, you're Brian. And if you're Dr. McLean, I'm Ms. Ellerby. I have already heard in the last 24 hours how everybody can't wait to see Kamala debate Pence, or Kamala versus Pence this. Okay, if she's Kamala, he's Mike. And if he's Pence, she is Ms. Harris.
Yeah.
I'd just like to make sure that we in the media make certain that we see that equivalency and stop talking about Hillary versus Trump, as we did last time. Her name is Kamala Harris.
So let us just focus in on that for a second and why that's important.
Words count, because words count. For example, let me give you some words, and you tell me what these words are the definition of. I went to the dictionary. Highly unpleasant, especially to the senses. Physically nauseating, as in, well, I won't use the example. Now, what do you think that's the definition of? Highly unpleasant, especially to the senses. Physically nauseating.
Nasty.
It's the first definition in the dictionary of the word nasty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I yesterday went online and ordered a nasty woman hoodie for fall and a Biden-Harris cap.
To the surprise of no one, Linda has a nasty woman.
And then I realized after doing these that I'm in quarantine. Nobody will see them but me and Ross. And I thought, I don't care.
Oh, Facebook them and put them out there.
Please do.
Jen, before we go to break, I'm also very interested. I mean, not only do we have the first African-American candidate, but we have the first Indian-American candidate. And I would assume that that is something that you would be pleased by.
You know, it's always exciting to see more representation across all identities, especially ones that are historically marginalized or underrepresented. But I think there is this whole other issue of, you know, intersectionality and how we digest that as a culture. She's still, even though she has, you know, two parents who added their heritage to her, she's still referred to as a Black woman often. And we don't often talk about Asian Americans and their role in society. Even though we have plenty of candidates, some people forget that Nikki Haley is Indian. And so I'm very curious to see where this conversation will lead and whether the conversation will turn not only just to Black and Latinx voters, but also more on Asian voters as well.
Do you think it will?
And I have something to add to that after the break. Jen, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
I'd love to continue discussing it after the break.
Okay. We have about a minute before we have to go to the break. So if you want to start discussing it now, that's fine.
Yes. You know, do I think there will be more attention to Asian American voters? On a national scale, probably no. I think on a local scale, that's made differences in different states, depending on where you live. But you can't ignore the fact that it's a growing population. And a lot of the issues that we're talking about are intrinsically tied to the Asian American population, which is a very diverse diaspora in itself. You know, sometimes people look at me and I say that I'm Asian and they look at me cross-eyed because I don't look, you know, lighter skinned Asian. Some people don't recognize the subcontinent as part of Asia, but it is. So we have a lot of history and catching up to do in that regard.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Jim, we'll get you in on this as well. We welcome your input as a listener. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. And we'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Jim Henler, and Linda Ellerbe. We were talking just before the break. Jen was talking about the historic nature of this. And I'll go back to you, Jen, and I know that Linda had something to add. And then we'll go to Jim and have him weigh in, and then we'll go to letters.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, we were talking about what the voting population knows about Asian American history and candidates. We can't forget that in Texas, there's a congressional candidate there who's also an Asian American, an Indian American who's running for office, which is going to be a rarity in that field. He's a Democrat, Sri Preston Kulkarni. So again, but we don't hear much of it until now when people are asking him, you know, what he thinks of Kamala Harris running for office and being the vice presidential nominee. So there's definitely a delay when it comes to hearing and knowing about Asian Americans in this country and, you know, their political influence as well, because they do have a lot of political and economical influence in our country and globally.
Wenda?
I was just, actually, Jen just said most of everything I was going to say, and, well, she should. Now, I merely was going to point out that, and as we have learned, and perhaps not wanted to face, Asians face as much discrimination as other non-white people in this country, and particularly at the moment with the president talking about the China virus. And people mm-hmm. do forget that India is part of Asia as well. And you said the rest of what I was going to say. It's time to hear from Jim.
All right. Jim Handler.
So, you know, it's been a whole day and a half now, Joe, so we've had time to see how the GOP is going to react. And I've really been enjoying this. CNN has a good summary this morning, but they say here are the first six kind of attacks on her. Kamala Harris is a socialist. Kamala Harris is a pawn of Wall Street. Kamala Harris is weak on crime. Kamala Harris is too aggressive as a prosecutor. Kamala Harris's ascent has the left in mutiny, and Kamala Harris is a puppet of the far left. So it seems like they haven't really figured out how they're going to attack yet. And I think
what they haven't figured out, Jim,
some of the strength.
It's a way to cover the code of what they really want to say, which is Kamala Harris is non-white and has a vagina.
Mm. Yep. But I think
because that,
you know, some of the strength
objection.
Of course. But I was going to say, but some of the strength as a candidate is that they can't do that pinholing as easily as they could for some of the others. And that's going to really mean they have to try to figure out a message to focus on. And it's going to be hard because this is a really good candidate. So I'm happy, like Alan is.
Yeah, and there is also the indication, which has come up in the news about that the Trump family has previously donated to her campaign as well as other campaigns. This is before Donald Trump was in office, but you know that's something that they're going to have to navigate as well.
Yeah, there's a copy floating around the internet of a $5,000 check from the Trump Foundation to.
Yeah, 5 or 6 thousand, right? Yeah, for AG, right? Mm-hmm. Alan, when you, as you said, you were very pleased in what you saw yesterday. We've been talking a little bit about the GOP, as Jim just brought up, of how they're trying to address this. Do you think that message will just become clear, or will always kind of be on the sidelines?
Well, Joe, they're desperately searching. In the polls, depending on which national polls you're looking at, many of us don't really take great comfort in them, but it's better than being the other way around. The Democrats are 10 to 15 points ahead of the Republicans. Now, you're Donald Trump, and you're looking for the magic button that will turn that around. And you'll try your hardest. It'll be China. It'll be this or that. But the fact is, you're behind. And coming from behind is going to be much more difficult than if you were on a sort of equal footing. That's their problem right now.
Linda, when you were talking about making the point about how the GOP is going to be dealing with this and has already started, and we started our discussion with you by talking about the Trump's use of nasty. That began with his treatment of Biden and then has now morphed into his treatment of Brett Kavanaugh. How lasting can that be?
Yeah, look, the first female presidential nominee of a major political party, Hillary Clinton, what did he call her? Nasty woman. The first female Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, nasty woman. The first female Black Asian American vice presidential nominee, nasty woman. Now, then you get to Giselle, currently in jail on sex trafficking charges. I wish her well, he says. Look, Trump has a problem with women. He does. He has a problem with strong women in particular, which is why I talked about the importance of words, because words do count, and how we in the media use them makes a big difference. I saw a story in the New York Times real estate section, I don't remember when, about the fact that real estate agencies and associations around the country are examining and stopping using the word master bedroom. Now, this comes about because of the Black Lives Matter movement and pressure, as it should. As a woman, I was you've heard me say this before, I was a single woman, the mother of two children and their sole support, and the sole support of my mother as she got older, and the caretaker of her. Okay? I'm just having a real problem with his problem with strong women or women in general. I mean, where I come from, and I'm about to probably use a word many of you may not know, and it's a word that I think I can say on the air, which makes it okay. Where I come from, we often, and that's Texas, we women often will say things about men like that as well. You know, a man who doesn't like women or is afraid of women probably has a teeny tiny tallywhacker. Now, I'm not implying that about President Trump, because believe me, I have no knowledge. But I am implying that how he is behaving is symptomatic. And this master bedroom thing, every time I would go to look for an apartment, and knowing this, and they would look at me and say, now here, let's show you the master bedroom. As a woman, I resented that.
Yeah.
I thought, why can't we just call it the primary bedroom, which it's now starting to be called? But it's just, that's a small example of how in our daily lives and our daily reporting, we don't examine our language.
So, and I'm not, please do not think in any way, shape, or form that I'm saying we shouldn't be doing this, because I believe that we should. But is there not a concern that this is part of what the Trump base and are reacting to, or were reacting to, at least in 2016, that there was a political correctness and that people couldn't say what they wanted to say, and that everything was that all those damn liberals were making a big deal over things that to them were not a big deal?
Well, of course, they are wrong about that, because people deserve to be called what they want to be called. And what those people are calling political correctness is simply they don't like being restricted on using the hate words they want to use. And so the Republican Party and Donald Trump have made it okay to use those words. And you know the words I'm talking about.
Right.
It is a little more than just political correctness to not political correctness police in the Republican Party stand on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
I think it's the bigger issues too, you know, that this decorum does not exist in language beyond you know, across the board. I mean, again, we can think just a couple of weeks ago where we heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's very dynamic speech calling this exact issue out as well, after she was insulted on a political floor. You know, this language against women does not make sense. And you know, a country and in a global world where women have been leaders and are going to continue to be leaders, yet they should not have to go to work every day to face this sort of extra layer of challenge and discrimination and hate, to be frank.
Not surprisingly, we got a lot of letters. We'll go to those letters in just a second. We're going to take a break. We have a wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Jim Hendler, and Linda Ellerby. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, and I thank you very much for being with us. We have a bunch of letters I want to get to here. Stacy writes, thank you, Linda, for making the point about name use equality. It is important and has been troubling me as well. Thank you, Linda, for pointing this out, says Tricia. Almost without exception, high-profile female politicians are called by their first names instead of their title. It diminishes them as equals in the sphere of politics and of their accomplishments. John says, the only issue I have with Kamala Harris is that she was a district attorney. For whatever reason, it seems to me that district attorneys often feel that they are above the law. How many district attorneys ever made good politicians? Elliot Spitzer, Chris Christie, how about Rudy Giuliani? Any idea why so many district attorneys act like criminals? Ooh, who wants to take that one on?
You can just answer that by saying Donald Trump was not a district attorney, but he is a criminal. So make your own conclusion.
Alan, what do you think?
Well, Linda makes a good point. We had a very interesting letter from a woman who thinks that sometimes when people use their first names, I'm a pretty good example of that. When people call me Dr. Chartok, I say, don't do that. Just call me Alan, because that's what I am. I think it creates a sense of intimacy that doesn't exist. But I do see Linda's point that with some regularity, women are demeaned to the first name and lowered to the first name, and they are not given the responsibility, the accolades that they deserve.
Jill writes, personally, I see nothing wrong with calling Kamala Harris Kamala, regardless of what other people are called. I think it would make people feel more comfortable and closer to her as a person, and especially as an African-American woman. It could be her brand, just like Hillary was just Hillary. To me, Pence will always be just Pence and Trump. We don't even use his name. Most of us in the African-American community just call him 45. Let's see. We go to Barbara, who says, it's not just Trump. Trump's problem with strong women is unfortunately a problem for so many of us, not just because of Trump, but due to the fact he is supported by many people countrywide who also have a problem with strong women. The misogyny in our country is palpable. Paula says, words do matter. Kamala Harris is a strong woman. Watch the word arrogant creep into the language of the GOP. It happens every time an assertive woman does what any man does every day.
Now, her brilliance, Joe, is that when you heard her speech, she anticipated some of this stuff. So she talked about family being number one on her list. She knows that these are the things that are going to be used against her and are used against women all the time. And she's not to be discounted because she wants to assure people that everything's fine.
But, Alan,
yes,
if I could just play devil's advocate there.
Please.
Why is it necessary for a woman to stand up and address the issue of, am I a good girl woman at the same time? Do I bake cookies? You don't hear men having to do that. Okay?
I'm going to give you an answer.
She's trying to take care of some of the objections that will come up because she is a woman. But that is something that every woman in any position of power has to do constantly. And it's a little tiring to have to defend yourself when they call you aggressive. You know, when I went to work first as a journalist, and people would write in and say, well, she is aggressive. Well, I was a journalist. If you say aggressive about a man, you usually mean it as a compliment. You say it about a woman, you usually mean it as an insult. Now, I personally found that I liked being aggressive. I didn't mind if any people called me that. But I still think women should not have to stand up and say, even though I am ambitious and I am aggressive and I'm a former prosecutor and I am running for president of the United States, don't worry, I'm also still a good mother and wife.
By the way, you're absolutely right about everything you're saying long term. However, I will point out to you, with great respect, as always, Linda, that she wants to win the election. So
I agree with you on that. I do absolutely agree with you on that. And I am the one to sit here and say, I think she's a risky choice. Nobody has said that yet, but I'm going to say it. I think she's a risky choice because she is a woman and because of the deep-seated misogyny in this country. We saw it come out with Hillary, and because of the racism, and we saw that come out with Obama. We as a country, this is about who we are. And as good a choice as I think she was for oh so many reasons, I don't think we should all look at this and say, oh boy, is that a safe choice? No. Anytime you are running a non-white person who is a woman, it is not safe at all.
You know what? Everybody is not the same. Hillary is not the same as Senator Harris. You know, to me, she is the epitome of somebody who is very bright and very accessible and wants to win an election and is going to do that. She's certainly capable of being assertive, as we've seen in the hearings and everything else. I think, frankly, she was the perfect choice. And if they win, it's going to be largely because of her.
I agree with you on all of that. I'm talking about the political reality of the election, that it is, as a nation, we have discovered we are much more racist and misogynist than we thought we were. I'm not condemning the risky choice. I'm applauding it. But I'm saying we need to be more aware than we were in 2016. The fact that people will lie to pollsters because nobody wants to be seen as anti-woman or anti-non-white person, although actually many don't mind as much today. But they will lie to pollsters. They did in 2016. And yes, she's not Hillary. But Hillary is not the only woman who's run for public office and been vilified because she is a woman.
Yeah, you make some very important points. But I still think that this was well thought out and a brilliant, brilliant choice for a brilliant woman.
We don't disagree on that. I'm just saying we need to keep being aware that there are many people who don't like that combination.
Right. Jim, you were going to chime in as well, I believe.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I agree with a lot of what I'm hearing, but, you know, one of the things that really impressed me was, so as I mentioned on the show before, I periodically flip back and forth between MSNBC and Fox to see how the same things are being covered. I actually found it really encouraging. They both picked exactly the same clip to show. Rachel Maddow and I forget who the Fox person was, both picked her attack on Trump. And it was just so literate and so well done that on one side, you know, it could be applauded, and on the other side, it could be viewed as, you know, clear provocation. But they weren't focusing on a lot of these issues. They had really picked the political nub of the thing, which is, you know, the role of the vice presidential candidate has often been the person who can do the attack. And I think we're really seeing that. And yes, that's going to get some people upset, but it was really done well and it was really done articulately. This is a brilliant person. And I think that to me is the really exciting part of all this.
Well, and I also think the tangible response to this choice, we've seen campaign donations go up. We've seen a lot of the other previous presidential candidates on the Democratic side come out and support this slate. And so I think we have to also be reminded of that. And I wanted to touch back briefly on the idea of how we're how these candidates are representing themselves. And I think what I pulled away from yesterday's presentation of the Biden-Harris slate is that both of them actually pitch themselves as family people as well as strong leaders and politicians. We heard that language in both of their speeches. And I think even in the Obama administration, something that really resonated with people was the fact that they were a very engaged and active family as well as folks who could dig into politics and policies. And so I think when you're looking at the optics and how people are being presented as candidates, I think you do have to find that balance, that blend of both being approachable, someone you can relate to, but also someone who's going to lead you through some really tough times right now. You can't ignore what any candidate has to face in the next 4+ years and how that's going to change our daily lives as American people. You know, that's got to be the focus as well.
And Jen, don't you think that a lot of people were watching Senator Harris and had the feeling, as they were, that she could be president of the United States based on what she was saying, her delivery, her ability to lay it all out, and to be a fighter? I think a lot of people were impressed at that level, because after all, Joe Biden is not the youngest man in the world, and there's a big presumption that this woman is being chosen to be president of the United States.
Right. And I think that, you know, that's something I think we're all taking into consideration as well. And I think it's really interesting to watch how they're going to be able to work as a team. I think this is going to be a very active team. And, you know, they've had their differences in the past. We saw that in the debates. And that wasn't brought up yesterday in any of their conversations. It was they both presented in each of their speeches a really clear and even pathway of how much they respected one another, how much they were ready to get to work. And now we got to see if they can walk the talk.
All right, we're going to pause there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Shartok, Jen Smith, Jim Hendler, and Linda Ellerby make up our panel. Ray Graff is next with news right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It's the 13th of August, 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. A wonderful panel assembled: Alan Shartok, Jen Smith, Jim Hendler, and Linda Ellerby. And of course, we do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Let's get to some of those letters. We have many. Go through them as quick as we can. We got this from Kara, who says, yes, Kamala Harris presented herself so well, she could be president. And by the way, she referred to Mr. Biden as Joe. And it was fine because the whole tone was that they will work together as a family. How refreshing. That from Kara. TJ says, last night Biden lost my vote. Why? Due to the DNC racist misogyny and war on progressives, allowing AOC, this brilliantly articulate woman, only 1 minute to address the virtual Democratic convention. I voted for every Democratic candidate for president since 1972, but being 68. But if the DNC is at war on progressives, then progressives must be at war with the right-wing DNC.
Did it ever occur to anybody that if, in fact, she hadn't been offered a prime time important spot, that would have been a worse insult?
Well,
also, can I reword the first line of that letter?
Absolutely.
He says, last night, Joe Biden lost my vote. The actual way that should read is, last night, I decided to vote for Donald Trump.
Right. Those are the choices.
Because that's the effect of what he just said.
Even if you don't vote.
Either he goes and votes for Trump, or he doesn't vote, which is a vote for Trump. I have no patience with this anymore. None.
Yep. Here, here.
Double that.
Okay. That from all right, that was TJ's vote. All right. Let's see. Mike says, what I have always observed about Kamala Harris is that she can stand up to a bully without sacrificing any dignity at all. Perhaps that rare ability makes her perfect in the current reality. Janet says, the letter you just read called Harris African-American. She is not. She is biracial, not black, and her black half is Jamaican, not African. She's a person of color. That's enough for me. I hope she's the right balance to the less than inspiring Biden.
Yeah, I think I just want to say that, again, we do need to pay attention to intersectionality and nuance. I mean, not only does she come from, you know, descendants who are from Jamaica and from India, but they also happen to be, her parents are researchers and from a very educated class compared to others. And you know, there's a lot of colorism in India, for example. There's a lot of classism in India, and we have to be mindful when we have these conversations, when we talk about multiracial, multicultural backgrounds, that there's a lot of nuance to that.
Linda, were you going to say something?
You know, I'm going to say something else specifically.
I agree with Jen. In fact, I think I said this last week, that I had come to realize myself that I've used phrases like white people and people of color as though those were two things. People of color is everybody else in the world but white people. There are all kinds of colors, all kinds of nuance. And even in my own language, I noticed that I had been saying white people and people of color without any nuance, as though, and white people are only one color, let's put it that way, of a rainbow of colors in this world.
Jim?
So I was going to go back to the AOC thing for one moment and just point out that she is so effective on social media and will do most of her part of the convention outside of the mainstream. I think not giving someone, you know, a minute on a Zoom talk, or only giving someone a minute on Zoom, is not going to have nearly the impact it would have in some other years. You know, I think if we get to the stories of QAnon and stuff, we'll be talking more about social media. But really, the impact of some of the people who are now in the party to get their messages out without having to be front stage with TV cameras, I think is really another interesting part of what we're seeing in a generational change in America.
Diane writes and says, most men had mothers unless they're interplanetary. When they grow up to bash women, deny places to women, dislike women, etc., are they secretly hating their mothers? Could be a long psychological discussion, but let's not go there. Let's remain focused on the objective. Women want equal positions in the world.
And as I said, Joe, there's every indication that by appointing Harris, you have created a potential president of the United States, which I think is really something that has been largely ignored. I mean, I think people know it, but it has been largely ignored in terms of the importance of the choice.
Right.
I think the difference, I guess, here is, I mean, anyone who's named a VP nominee is a potential president of the United States. But I think in Senator Harris's case, she has run for president, and I think we saw last night that she carries herself very presidentially, and I think that's what, in essence, makes her really stand out.
Well, and she's running for president with a 78-year-old man, or at least someone who will be 78 when he is inaugurated president.
Right, and we could say the same thing with you know, Pence, but we don't talk about Pence in that way. You know, I mean, he's also a veep to a very old man who doesn't wear a mask.
Well, and we can, you know, we can compare the
61,
current vice presidential,
Mike Pence. Go ahead.
The current vice presidential presumptive Kamala Harris. I was looking for the right title there, but for the last time we had a vice presidential female candidate who was not someone who anyone believed was going to make a good president, and it really ended up hurting the campaign for McCain. So, you know, I think that really you have to not only look at all these issues, but again, as just the strength of this person as a politician and as a leader is just really good. I mean, you know, it's you know, I mean, again, we could make talk about all the intersectionality, all the different issues. I think that's all very important. But I think at the heart of it is the fact that this is a really strong, savvy politician who understands the world we live in and what's needed to get us out of the hole that Trump has dug us into.
Let's go back to the letters. And Amy, who says, as a woman, I would rather put less effort into trying to legitimize the nasty woman label and more into convincing society that an intelligent and assertive woman is an asset, not something to be ridiculed or feared. Then we go to Herb.
Which is very interesting, because that's clearly what Trump is trying to do, right? And so you say, you know, somebody, I mean, I would not even entertain his nonsense. It's so clear he is looking for anything that will get him over on both Joe and the senator. I mean, it's beyond me that anybody takes his efforts seriously here.
And but they do. They do take them seriously.
I know.
And we can't minimize the problems that any woman is going to face. And by the way, I want to point out that I happen to believe that Kamala Harris' choice is excellent. I support this team in every way. I did not mean to imply anything else when I said it was risky. I simply mean that we often vote against our own self-interest in this country. The New York Times had a long piece this last week about why do people vote in their economic self-interest against their own economic self-interest. Well, you can ask the same thing about why did so many women vote for Trump? Or you can just, Alan, I ask you to remember this sentence. Equality of rights under law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Now, that is the Equal Rights Amendment. It was introduced in 1920. It still is not part of the Constitution, and yet 80% of Americans mistakenly believe that women and men are already guaranteed equal rights by the Constitution. We're not. We're guaranteed the right to vote, and women defeated the Equal Rights Amendment. Women will vote against their self-interest in many cases, the same way people vote against their own economic interest and for many reasons, and that's a topic for another time. But we do have to worry about it.
And I just want to note that on paper, yes, everyone has the right to vote, but in practice, we know that's not an equitable reality.
Right. Herb checks in on this subject and says, I look forward to a day when a person can run on their ability to do the job and their records rather than their sex and their nationality. Gordon says, after Trump loses, watch out for the time period between Trump's election loss and the inauguration. Trump, his appointees, and many Republicans will try to steal everything that isn't nailed down. They will loot the public treasury as much as they can get away with.
That's very scary. It's a very serious letter. I don't know the specifics, but it is very scary, because the one thing we know about this guy is he ignores the norms and he does whatever is in his own self-interest. And I have no doubt.
And I'm also scared about what his followers will do.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm really scared. You know, we have a lot of
that is all scary stuff. You know, I don't know. I'm not enough of a constitutional scholar to know if this could happen. But it has seemed to me that if the Democratic Party candidates win, and win big, and it is clear, it is not in doubt, Trump has lost. And if the Democrats take the Senate as well, why could the House not vote to impeach the next day and the Senate vote to convict and get him out of office and let Pence be vice president until January 20th?
We'll get all kinds of letters, Linda, that say, are you sure? Are you sure that that's a good thing?
Well, and with that Senate vote, I mean, we still have...
Oh, yeah, they
if we take the Senate, I believe that if the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, I believe that a number of Republicans will find some spine.
If they've been voted out?
They will see Exactly. Now, and, you know, the first obligation of any politician is to stay in office. So I have wondered if that would be possible. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. And by the way, just one little extra added thing, because I love doing this show with you all once a week. I am thoroughly enjoying it. And one of the things that I enjoy most is that after 50 years as a journalist, I am just speaking my own opinion now.
That's great.
Just saying exactly what I think. That's fun.
We wouldn't want it any other way, Linda.
You know, it's so funny because we've had journalists who've been on this program for a long time. I think of Judy Patrick. I think of Mike Spain. And man, when they retired, they get to go off, and boy, they're having a blast.
It's very freeing.
I was going to say, can we put Rosemary in that group?
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely. Anne writes and says, does anyone on the panel think Trump will dump Pence and put a black man on the ticket?
No, but he might put a woman on the ticket.
No.
Let's see. Andrea.
Wait. I heard a no. What's the no here?
Was it Jim?
It was me. I think it's too late for him to make a change.
Well, I think you're probably on the safe side, but he is going to be desperate, and he is running way behind. Mm-hmm. I don't care what people say about the pollsters. You know, we heard a remark earlier that the polls were all wrong in the Hillary election. No, they weren't. The polls in terms of the national vote were absolutely correct. What happened was there was very close race in three states, but the polls were basically right.
Let's see.
In those states, it was within the margin of error.
Donald Trump is sitting in the White House. I'm not disagreeing with you, Alan. I know the history. I know the various states. I can name them. I know all of that. But I also know that many people did, in fact, lie to pollsters because we vote by secret ballot. And by the way, I think that's a good thing. I'm not suggesting a change in that. But when you're voting by secret ballot, what you're telling somebody who's asking you as a pollster doesn't have to match.
But you got 300.
Actually, Linda,
go ahead, Jim. And then go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
So I looked at all the numbers at a fairly deep level. Being a data geek, that's what I did instead of drinking for the next 3 days after the election. But it became eminently clear, and I actually had a piece on this radio station, that it was people who stayed home. So it was people who didn't, it wasn't lying to the pollsters. It was simply at the last minute deciding they weren't going to go vote. And if you just take those numbers and put the number of people who, I won't go into the technical details. I can, you know, justify this, but suffice to say there was a very clear amount of evidence that a number of people went to the polls and either didn't vote for president at all or voted for one of the third party candidates. And that was enough to have made the difference in those states.
And yet she still got 300,000.
I agree with that. I wasn't talking about exit polls. I was talking about pre-election day polls.
Yeah.
No. I'm talking pre-election polls. I'm talking if you look at the poll numbers, if you compare them to what happened, if you take the number of likely voters who actually showed up. So again, I don't disagree with you that there are people who lie to pollsters, and it's traditionally been the case that you see that most. So I lived in Virginia when they had a black candidate running for governor. And again, you saw a lot of that same kind of thing, people who said they were firm. And then when the actual election happened, it was much closer. But in this case, you could really see very clearly it's people not voting. So I think the real message this year is we must get out the vote.
Alan always.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that goes to the point of the letter that we got a few moments ago about the fact of AOC and therefore not going to vote for Biden. He lost my vote last night. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We saw that. We saw where that got you in 2016. If you want to get that again, if you want to lose the country, vote for somebody, a third party candidate, or stay home. That's a fine way to help you lose the country.
Alan always will often ask me to about polls and what the latest is. 538 saying this is data just about half an hour ago, saying there hasn't been much high quality polling as we inch closer to the conventions, but we got some new national and state polls yesterday. So far, it doesn't seem as if Joe Biden's advantage is shrinking at all. He still leads President Trump by more than 8 points in our national polling average. However, there are some state polls that have shown better numbers for Trump in recent days. No polling has taken into account the addition of Kamala Harris to the ticket. So that is where we are at the moment. Just a letter or two, and then we'll move on to some other stuff here before we have to take a break. Andrea said, I would not vote for anyone based on sex or ethnicity. I vote based on what they stand for and integrity. I don't think we need to keep discussing anyone's heritage. Well?
Well, it's just wrong. I mean, we know that, and I'd like to go to Jim on this. But we also know that people tend to vote when they have somebody that they think they can identify with. And that's why it is so important to remember why this pick is so relevant. You know, if you're Indian American and you have an Indian candidate on the ballot, you can tell me it shouldn't matter. It does matter. Same thing with black candidates. We saw that with turnout for Barack Obama. So it's nice to give the American credo. But on the other hand, there's a political reality here.
Jim, do you want to respond to that?
So, yeah, you know, Alan, you've said in the past on this show many times that where this thing will be won or lost, and the data agrees with you, is in suburban districts in a few states, unless there's a massive swing, which it's now looking like could conceivably happen. But if you have something even at all similar to the last election, it's really, you know, the inner cities are going the way they went, and the rural areas are going the way they went. And so it's going to be a fight for voters in that middle. And again, that's a very interesting demographic when you map it against some of these different areas. So again, you know, it makes it harder to call, but I think you're right. I think the strong candidate who you can identify with does pull people in those demographics, and that we have seen in voting numbers in the past.
Here's an interesting letter from Johnny, who says, good morning, Roundtable. I read on Facebook that Senator Harris cannot be VP because she is a quote-unquote anchor child because of her parents being immigrants. So if Biden is unable to finish his term, VP goes to the speaker. Is this fake news? I believe it is.
It is. Of course it's fake news.
It is fake news, and I advise that person to go to Snopes.com. And look it up. They have a very long take on that today. She is absolutely legally qualified to be president of the United States.
She was born in the U.S.
and laws of the United States.
Do you really think that they would have chosen her if that weren't true?
Would have slipped through the vetting process, right?
Will you give me a break?
All right.
Really, I mean, this is just nonsense.
So what you just heard is a thinly veiled attack on Nancy Pelosi.
I'm sorry?
What? I was just going to say, see, what you're seeing is that Trump would much rather be running against Nancy Pelosi.
And
so that was a way to, that misinformation is a way to say, you know, they're putting in Harris as a, you know, as a fake. And, you know, if anything happens to Biden, you'll have Pelosi. Worry about that, which, of course, is a lie. But lies has not bothered this administration any way, shape, or form. So why should one more question?
I want to talk about this. We only have a few. Go ahead.
Can I just
Jen.
Say something
you certainly
really
can.
Quickly? I just
actually, if you take 2 minutes,
that
it's even better. But go ahead.
just the term itself of an anchor baby is really grates me. It's actually a very derogatory term. It's not a technical term by any means. So I just wanted to make that letter writer also aware, and everyone listening also aware, that that's not appropriate. And I think it's in a similar vein as some of the attacks on President Barack Obama and his his heritage and his birth, you know, steer clear of that and stick with the facts.
We should note in just before we go to a break here that yesterday the United States of America reported the highest number of COVID-19 deaths in one day since mid-May. As the United States reported its highest number, President Trump on Wednesday continued to press for the nation's schools to bring children into classrooms, for businesses to open, and for athletes to fill stadiums. Trump said in an evening news conference at the White House, "We've got to open up our schools and open up our businesses," adding that he wanted to see a college football season this fall. "Let them play," he said. The president also made his latest concerted push to get students back into U.S. schools, saying that 99.9% of deaths from the coronavirus pandemic involve adults. He threatened to divert federal money from schools that don't open and warned of the intellectual damage that could result if children remain at home indefinitely. And I'll just allow you to think about that for a moment, of the president concerned about intellectual damage.
But he knows.
Yes, in fact, he said, he said in that quote, "When you sit at home in a basement looking at a computer, your brain starts to wither away." Now, I want you to have the visual mental image of Trump sitting at home looking at a computer. I'm having trouble with that image.
Well, you can play Fox News on your computer.
Yeah, well, you know, what I love here is that obviously this president is having his pollsters look into what will turn people on. And they ask the question, "Would you like to have sports on television?" Overwhelmingly, people say yes. But when then you ask the second question, which is, "If it means your life or your children's life, would you like to have sports on television?" Those same people are saying no. We know that. But he still has nowhere to go except to try to play the sports card to create an audience for himself.
And at least two.
If I could, I know I've talked too much this morning, but I want to add.
We just have 10 seconds. Never. We just have 10 seconds for a break. But go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so let's pause, and when we come back, I'll go come right to you, I promise, Linda. We'll be back right after this.
And
we'll
I'll do be our, brief, I promise.
We'll take our break right after and talk right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Linda, I promised you the floor. Go ahead.
I'm actually not going to go there because we have a limited time left. I have talked too much, and I really want to hear what all of you have to say about QAnon. I need to learn.
You never talk too much, Linda.
We love having you.
I will come back to what I was going to say on another day, because if what I was going to say is something that's not going away and doesn't have to be talked about today. And as I said, I want to hear what Jim has to say about QAnon. I want to learn something here. I know that Jen and Jim know, and Joe and you and Alan know more about it than I do.
So this is QAnon is obviously in the news now, and it is something. There's an article in the New York Times this morning about QAnon followers are hijacking the Save the Children movement. This is a pro-Trump conspiracy theory that they're clogging anti-trafficking hotlines, infiltrating Facebook groups, and raising false fears about children and enslavement and children exploitation. Jim, because of the social media aspect of this, give us a sense of what this is and ultimately how it has gained such steam.
So let's start back at the beginning. Where does it get the name? So Q is a clearance that is given by the Department of Energy. It's essentially their lowest level of top secret clearance. I am allowed to say in public that I do hold a Q clearance. I have Department of Energy clearances higher than that. Theoretically, you're not allowed to say anything when you have such a clearance about whether anything is or is not being kept. They have let us talk about QAnon because it is so ridiculous. So what QAnon started from was some quick Twitter accounts claiming to have this clearance, claiming that the Department of Energy was sitting on top of various things about conspiracies and things like that. And they started basically just going into social media and finding places where their conspiracy theories would get good uptake from other people's things. So they went to things like the vaccine, anti-vaxxers and things like that. As they started to pick up followers, they've started more and more to move into those places where you have real concerns, health and things like that. Now they're going after the Save the Children movement. So QAnon, for example, says that elite Democrats have been basically stealing children and eating them for I forget what it is. It's some secret energy thing that lets them live longer or something. It's bizarre. I will tell you, without violating any of the rules of my clearance, that I have never been invited to eat a child anywhere in the government. And in fact, they're not kosher, so I'm happy I haven't been invited. But it's crazy. And it's a crazy conspiracy theory that has been growing and growing. And what you have is a bunch of people who, you know, we have a flat earth movement now. They've started to align with the QAnon. We have things. So people who just question science, people who just question anybody who doesn't sound as crazy as they are flocking to this. And of course, on social media, as something grows, it propagates. And now there's a lot of fear about the fact that what happens is they're taking legitimate things such as Save the Children and starting to get many, many of their followers to start to flood social media in those spaces, which drowns out the real voices. So in terms of kid, you know, of child trafficking, it makes it really hard to get out the word that there's real stuff happening and is dangerous when people still believe Pizzagate. And these guys are firm believers in Pizzagate. So it's a scary, crazy conspiracy that has been very, very savvy about how to move and work in social media. There's a lot of different theories about who's funding it, but it seems like it's very much almost like a Black Lives Matter or something like that, where enough people forming a nub of it form a message, and then other people pick that up and propagate it. And then in the case of QAnon, some people have clearly picked that up because they see it as helpful to the Trump campaign. There's others who picked it up for other reasons. So it's a very scary phenomenon. It's still a fringe. You know, the problem is, somebody once said to me, come up with any conspiracy theory you want and you can get 10% of America to believe it. And the problem is, you know, these are a very noisy 10%. And when 10% of people are very noisy, that there's some math that shows that propagates well.
But you do
you really have a scary phenomenon going on here.
Even whether it's 10%, you do have a House candidate who has espoused this QAnon conspiracy theory, Marjorie Taylor Greene. She won her Georgia primary Tuesday evening. The president tweeted that she was a future Republican star, was strong on everything, and never gives up, a real winner. The Office of House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who ignored multiple pleas from his members to wade into the primary, has said he will seat her on congressional committees. She's almost, because of the makeup of that district, is almost guaranteed to win in the fall. But here is a woman who has made racist statements and espoused this conspiracy theory and is certainly highlighting the party's willingness to tolerate extreme and bigoted positions.
You know, she's certainly not the first insane conspiracy theorist to make it into
the House of Representatives,
and that's on both sides. I mean, I remember a Florida candidate who ran on the fact it was something about a conspiracy about Britain trying to take back the United States, and she won. Right. The good news is one person in the House doesn't do much unless they get picked up by their party.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's just this craziness of finding a base that you can build on and not worrying about what they do for the country and what they do, what they believe in, but wanting them to help you. And QAnon has just been doing that in spades.
Linda, what do you make of it?
As I understand it, I mean, because one of the one of the downsides of the internet is the difficulty of finding a shared reality right now for all of us. That this is about far more than torturing children, as if that weren't bad enough. I mean, this is about the conspiracy that Clinton and Obama and, you know, the deep state have plans, and the clash between good and evil cannot be avoided, and you must, and you know all this because you believe in Q. And there are people out there who believe Q is President Trump. There are all kinds of crazy things going out there. I would like to recommend, the only thing I know about this really, other than just what I've sort of read in the newspapers, I would like to recommend to all of you who want to know more, and talking about what Jim has said already, is to go to The Atlantic. There is a whole series of articles called Shadowlands. Yes. And there is a long one of these that was written by Adrienne LaFrance, who is the executive editor of The Atlantic, on QAnon. And it will surely open your eyes to a lot of things that I read yesterday in preparation for today and realized how little I knew about all of this. That's why I wanted to hear Jim on it, and still want to.
You can have him back if you go back to Nickelodeon. Go ahead.
Right. Well, Linda, I'm happy to do a show with you somewhere.
We did that already.
I think the key thing is that because of the way social media works, because of the way the algorithms amplify messages, the people who've been savvy to that have really taken advantage. And the less scrupulous you are, the less, you know, honest you are, the easier it is to do that. And so the dark side of the web, and we're even still talking about the public web. There's parts of the web that are far scarier than this, which some of which I can talk about in public. And there, you know, look at dark web if you want to look that up. But there's some, you know, I can't even talk about in public that scare me to death. That's part of why I was brought in to help deal with some of these issues. Because, you know, you subvert someone who does have certain powers and it gets scary. And, you know, the amazing thing is where other administrations have either at least ignored these crazies and, when necessary, done counter messaging, the Trump administration has been retweeting them. And when not Trump himself, it's been his kids who are, you know, retweeting absolutely insane things. And of course, when you have that many followers and that kind of name, you know, so it's not just the social media. It's also when the president of the United States gives credibility to your conspiracy theory. It grows. And, you know, I can actually date some of this back to the early days of climate change. A lot of the quote controversy over climate change, unquote, came about for political reasons and people making these same kind of things. So it was basically a way to run against Al Gore. And it's just, to me, you know, hard to put myself in that mental head. But when I have to, you can just see these craziness of how all this connects. And it's really is scary. And, you know, one of the things that worries me is these are also now very tied to Second Amendment rights people, which means you have a lot of gun-toting crazies who, no matter what the outcome, if, you know, if Trump loses this election, they're going to believe that the election was not fair. And, you know, imagine the, you know, the women's march against Trump, but with instead a bunch of crazy white males with guns. It gets very scary.
Jen?
I think the thing that scares me the most is that there's such a distrust in good journalism and good research, good science, that people are turning to these alternative sources for information. And, you know, if you're going to be passionate about sex trafficking or child protections, QAnon should not be your primary source. Twitter should not be your primary source of information. We know that those two issues that I just mentioned have existed for centuries, really, in society. And we know that, you know, that predates QAnon. So why the American public is buying into this by the tens and the thousands, not only in readership, but in donations and, and you know, investing in these causes and campaigns. And I think that's what scares me the most. And the fact that this group is tearing away precious resources from very important issues of forced labor and exploitation of people. That's what scares me the most. And the fact it also draws away from people, real people, who are in who have taken advantage of these systems, whether it's sex trafficking or forced labor. And this is a white collar crime. This is not, you know, just like a child abduction or something like that. These are those illicit spas and massage parlors that are bringing in people from South Asia and East Asia, primarily also Mexico and within the U.S. You know, conversely, it's on the global scale. This is where people are, you know, vulnerable people are being lured away from the U.S. and brought into trafficking channels in other parts of the world. And this is really a global issue that is way bigger and far predates QAnon. So the fact that the two are tied together is, you know, really concerning and really wrong. You should not be going there as your primary source.
I do. We have to wrap up, and I apologize, but we are out of time. I wanted to just leave a minute at the end here to just give listeners, and many of our volunteers know this, but we lost someone who was very special to the station and to this region. Regen Adams passed away. She was 93 years old, was an Albany legend, was a great social activist in this region. I don't think there was a protest or a movement that she was not a part of and was very active. But certainly Alan was one of our great volunteers and had been for a very, very long time.
She will not be forgotten by all of us who just depended on her. You could come into a fund drive, and there she would be. Very, very important. If we had an event at the Linda, there she would be.
There she was.
Was a permanent fixture at WAMC.
Well, we just wanted to say rest in peace and obviously to say how much she meant to all of us and to this community. Regen Adams passing away at 93. Absolutely. My thanks to the whole group this morning. Alan, thank you very much. Jen Smith, Jim Hendler, Linda Ellerby, a pleasure having you all on this morning. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon. Coming up next, the Congressional Corner on WAMC. Mm-hmm.